something. Some insecurity, Truman felt, instantly determined to locate its source, prevented her from showing it. No. Barbara Paley's style, her beauty, her legendary polish was artificial, cultivated over a lifetime of discipline and discernment. And she did not take pains to hide the fact. She was heavily made up. Eyebrows perfectly groomed and brushed and colored, those glittering, deep-set eyes coated in subtle, complementary eyeshadows and liners and mascara. Those high, sculpted cheekbones were further enhanced, with the precision of a professional, by blush, several shades artfully blended together, and her skin, while luminous, was that way due to foundation, thickly applied, yet somehow not appearing to be, buffed completely, no lines of demarcation, dewy-looking, fresh. But still, it was makeup. Beautifully, painstakingly applied, you could gasp at the mastery of it, and appreciate the skill and time necessary. Babe was no blank canvas. Her face was a work of art, and she, not God, was the artist. Her hair, too, so perfectly yet naturally sculpted and waved to give the appearance of insouciance, thick and brown but with silver streaks weaving through it, catching the light, so chic and unexpected. Yet again, one sensed the effort that went into it, while marveling at the result. And the clothes, the accessories, a still life, artfully arranged. Taken separately, they were not spectacular. Black Italian loafers, perfectly tailored khaki slacks, a crisp white linen shirt, a glittering diamond necklace. But it was the way they were arranged. The shirt, tucked in the front, not the back. The diamond necklace, not worn about the throat, but wrapped casually about Babe's left wrist. Expected, yet not. Recognizable, yet unattainable. And here was this woman, this icon whose face had graced the pages of Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Life, peering worriedly into her mirror, taking a small brush and blending something beneath her eyes, blotting at her nose with a powder puff, a delicate blue vein on her forehead beginning to dance with tension. "I hope he's not home yet. Oh, if I'm not there, standing in the hall to greet him, to look wonderful for him." Suddenly there was a pounding on the bedroom door. Two brisk knocks. Then the handle turned, and he was there, striding into the bedroom, shouting, "Babe! Babe!" Babe jumped from her stool, swiftly swiped her lips with a lipstick, not a smudge or a smear, smoothed her shirt and gazed at Truman with heartbreakingly helpless, uncertain eyes. "How do I look?" she whispered. "Perfect," he replied, for it was only the truth. Grasping his hand for confidence, a gesture that touched his heart, she sucked in her stomach and took a big breath. "Bill, darling," she cooed in that soothing voice. She walked unhurriedly into her bedroom to greet her husband, as if she'd been sitting in a beauty parlor for hours, idly paging through a magazine. "Oh, I'm so glad you're home. I've simply been bored all day without you. Would you like a drink, darling? I know you would. I'll get it in a jiffy. Meanwhile, you remember Truman, don't you? You two go downstairs and wait for me in the drawing room. I'll just change quickly for dinner, and get you that drink before you know it." Truman smiled, put out his hand. "Bill, I hope you don't mind that I borrowed your beautiful wife for the afternoon, but I return her to you now, no strings attached." William S. Paley, founder and chairman of the board of CBS, advisor to President Eisenhower, the man who discovered Bing Crosby and Edward R. Murrow, and the zany redhead and her Cuban husband, who were currently the most popular stars on that still new medium called television, squinted down at the graceful, lily-white hand extended to him. He frowned at his wife, who stood before him, gazing worshipfully at him as if he were Zeus himself come down from Mount Olympus. He pulled himself up, all 6 feet 2 inches of him, and grunted.
"I'm starving. What's for dinner?"
"Lamb chops, so tender you can eat them with a spoon, and these adorable baby vegetables I found in the city and brought out with me today in a little wicker basket, and potatoes, new and succulent, with butter and rosemary picked fresh just an hour ago." Babe narrated the upcoming meal with the crisp, yet poetic professionalism of a food stylist or a critic from the New York Times.
"All right."
Suddenly, Bill Paley smiled. It was an enormous, cocky, glad-to-see-you grin that crinkled up his eyes and made him seem, Truman thought at that moment, like a man who had just swallowed an entire human being. "Oh, that was very good," Truman said to himself. That was the keeper, a man who had just swallowed an entire human being. He filed it away in his photographic memory, to be used at a later date. Yet the grin was infectious, changing Bill Paley's whole demeanor. Truman couldn't help but grin back.
"Come on, Truman. Nice to see you again. I'll show you around. Don't take too long, Babe."
"Of course I won't, darling." Babe laid her hand on her husband's arm and tiptoed up to give him a kiss on the cheek. She was only a couple of inches shorter than he, and Truman noticed, for the first time, that she was wearing flats, and that she always wore flats. Bill Paley, still grinning, rubbing his hands together in anticipation of the meal ahead, turned on his heel, striding quickly out of the room, not even turning to see if Truman was following, but something in the sureness of his gait, the way his arms swung, like a general's, indicating that he knew that Truman was. This was a man obviously used to barking out orders and having them followed. And Truman did. With a quick, sympathetic glance at Babe, who rewarded him with another glimpse behind her mask of perfection, a small, involuntary little grimace. But when she reappeared, not 10 minutes later, in the perfectly appointed drawing room full of exquisite antiques, rare paintings, yet somehow so comfortable that sinking into one of the upholstered chairs was like sinking into a nap. She was as serene as ever, wearing a column of silk, draped about her tall form like an exquisitely tailored toga, the neckline a deep slash to her sternum, a slim black belt encircling her non-existent waist. Her makeup was perfect. Not a hair out of place. She looked as if she could glide into the Plaza ballroom. Except for her feet. They were elegant, arched and bare, toenails glittering with a ruby-red polish, brushing the top of her surprising pale feet. The hemline of her gown tingled softly. "Jingle bells!" Truman cried, so delighted he clapped his hands. The creature had sewn jingle bells into the hem of her couture gown. "Shh!" Babe put her finger to her lips, sharing the secret with a conspiratorial grin, and so she chimed, softly, faintly, Tinkerbell in Givenchy, wherever she glided, to and from the bar, handing Bill his drink, getting one for Truman, offering them both a silver plate of hors d'oeuvres that had magically appeared, making sure the fire was just the right temperature. turning on lamps that shone with the most amazing, flattering light, faintly pink, not white. Finally, settling down at her husband's feet, her skirt rustling a musical crescendo, to remove his shoes, massage his insteps, and suggest, "Now tell me about your day, my darling. I want to know every detail. You look as if you've been through the ringer, poor baby." Bill Paley, his tie off, his Italian shirt opened at the neck, a Manhattan in one hand, a crisp, bacon-wrapped fig in the other, didn't respond. He didn't even glance at the gorgeous creature kneeling at his feet. He did, however, study Truman with heavily lidded, reptilian eyes. And Truman, watching the scene, frowned. His goddess turned into a mere housewife. If this was what her mother had trained her for, then God damn her soul.
Chapter 4. Darling, you don't know. You simply can't understand how glorious they were, those girls. They still are. But when they first arrived, you simply can't appreciate the sensation they made, all three of them. Betsy, Minnie, and Babe.
Then tell me, my pet, my divine one, Truman cooed, sitting with his legs tucked beneath him, on a fragile-looking yet sturdy oriental chair.
Truman, I do have a job, you know. Although God knows Hearst pays me pennies to do it.
Diana Vreeland, fashion editor, thrust her chin out and smiled her monkey smile. A big scarlet-rouged grin that made her ears stick out even more prominently than usual. Her yellow teeth, framed by viciously red lips, tore into the words with gusto. Her black hair, so lacquered you couldn't see the individual strands, was brushed severely back and held in a blue-black snood. An incongruous wide satin bow corralled the front of her hair back from her forehead. As she spoke, her long tapered fingers flew and beckoned and pronounced, punctuated by pointy red talons. Truman was in her office at Harper's Bazaar. On her desk, on the credenza, flickered the jewel-toned, richly scented Rigaud candles every rich woman he knew favored. There were photos, drawings, bits of fabric in every hue and weight, hats, gloves, all pinned to the walls. As he sat, he had the distinct impression that hovering outside were armies of emaciated mannequins clad in the latest styles, waiting to be told, "Yes, divine," or, "God, no, that's ghastly." An entire world of fur and satin and cashmere and chiffon and silk. Hemlines of dizzying lengths, exquisitely impractical shoes, nervous designers and languid models, all awaiting Mrs. Vreeland's pronouncement, which she would surely give. She gazed at the world with those myopic, glittering, slanted eyes and passed judgment. Editing, always editing, even life itself.
"But I wasn't quite aware then, you know," Truman reminded her. "I wasn't yet fully formed. An embryo. That's what I was. You must tell me. I have fallen in love, you see. Fallen in love with the most glorious creature, and I simply must know more about her."
"Fallen in love?"
Diana raised a perfectly arched eyebrow.
"Oh, yes. Truly. Not in the physical sense, of course. But if I could, she would be the one. Even as the idea is simply revolting, but somehow less revolting with Babe."
"You have no idea what you're talking about," Diana snorted.
Truman's eyes, usually so wide and sparkling with mischief, hardened. He set his jaw in a way few people ever saw. Few of his society friends, anyway. Others were very well acquainted with that shrewd, determined look. His lover, Jack Dunphy. His friend from Monroeville, Nell Harper Lee. His mother, Nina / Lily May, certainly had been on the wrong end of it in her lifetime, as had various schoolmates who went one step too far in their teasing and bullying, as had Humphrey Bogart, when he challenged Truman on the set of Beat the Devil to an arm-wrestling contest. Humphrey Bogart, his wrist nearly snapped off his arm, never teased Truman Capote again.
Yes, I do know what I'm talking about, as a matter of fact,
Truman replied evenly. Diana Vreeland shrugged. She refilled her cigarette holder from a silver box on her desk, struck a match, lit the cigarette, puffed, and leaned forward.
Darling, it was like this,
Diana began in her sandpaper bleat. And Truman smiled, closed his eyes, the better to imagine, and listened to the story of the three beautiful Cushing sisters. First, I suppose, we have to start with the mother. Goggs. That's what she was called by the girls. The most ordinary woman, darling. Not a spark of anything to her at first glance. A matron from Ohio, plump, correct in every way. The most beautiful manners, which you see in the girls to this very day. But a housefrau, a total geisha to that husband, Harvey Cushing. He was a genius, of course. Divine. Quite handsome. A surgeon. A brain surgeon. He absolutely invented brain surgery. And the mother, Goggs, she waited for him forever until he felt he was established. And once married, provided him with the most serene house in life. Everything run perfectly. A real salon in Boston, where he went to work, you know. What a ghastly place is Boston, isn't it, darling? No imagination, colorless. The clothes. Well, let's not speak of the clothes. And Goggs, she was shrewd. She knew that her two boys could fend for themselves, but her girls would never be truly accepted by Boston society simply because she and Harvey weren't from there. And you know those Brahmins. It takes generations to get in. And old Goggsy, she was determined that her three beautiful girls would marry the best, the very best, princes and shahs, or at the very least, mountains of money. Gobs and gobs of it. Betsy was the most like her mother. Rather a mousy little thing, I sometimes think, until she gives you that imperious look down her nose. Betsy's the most mannered in her way, as if she truly was the Queen of England. She was the first to marry, to James Roosevelt, son of FDR, the president's daughter-in-law, a brilliant match, of course. Except that James couldn't keep his pecker in his pants and all but abandoned Betsy and their two little girls. But FDR adored her, adored her. Eleanor, of course, detested her. She didn't like Betsy taking her place by FDR's side, but then Eleanor was never there herself. What a dreary woman she is.
And a big old lev, said Truman.
Oh, darling. That's old news, said Diana. But why are lesbians always so dowdy? I would love to know. It simply doesn't make sense. Why women dress for women anyway? Everyone knows that.
Well, I don't know, Truman said and sniffed. It's not like we all have a club or anything.
Anyway, Betsy's wedding to young Roosevelt was quite the coup, of course. It brought the Cushings into old New York, leapfrogging over stuffy old Boston. The Roosevelts and the Knickerbockers and all that fabulous old musty society, which still counts, you know. Not as much as it used to, but it still does. Good
God, I would say so. And due to Sister Betsy's marriage, Babe's coming out party was held at the White House. So you'd think that Goggs would be satisfied. But she still had the other two to launch. And Betsy's marriage was in trouble. But I'll give the old girl this much. She always told those three girls to stick together no matter what. And they did. They were a triumvirate. All slender, with those cutting cheekbones like a ship's prow, although Minnie is too much of a scarecrow for my taste. A girl should have a little meat on her bones, so the clothes will hang. But the most beautiful, of course, was Babe. Beautiful Babe. That's what they called her from the instant she was born, and the other two simply never were jealous of her to hear them say it, but I think Betsy secretly is. Not Minnie. She's not got a jealous bone in her bony body, but Betsy used to be the queen, and now she isn't. But Babe had a dreadful car accident when she was 19. Did you know? Truman, his eyes wide with horror, shook his head. Oh, yes. Legend has it the young man was so besotted by her beauty, he turned to gaze at her and ran smack into a tree. Babe's face was horribly disfigured, apparently, but her father brought in the very best surgeons and patched it all up. You can't even tell. She's as beautiful as before. Maybe even more so. Betsy divorced Roosevelt. Then Minnie started her affair with Vincent Astor. The Cushing girls were truly in New York now, appearing at all the nightclubs, the charity functions. Gogsy didn't much like this at first. Mother Cushing was Victorian, you see. From the time when a lady did not go out, get photographed, have her name in the papers. But this was in the 40s, when cafe society was really in, of course. Charlie Knickerbocker's column. If you wanted a man, a real catch, as those girls did, as they were brought up to do, you had to be seen in the right places, be in the newspapers. So those girls stuck together, and brother, what an entrance they made. The three of them entering the Stork Club. Golly, what a sight. Regal Betsy, the former Roosevelt, tall, kind Minnie, whom everyone knew was sleeping with Vincent Astor on top of simply piles and piles of money, and Babe, the beautiful, sweet Babe, whom I've never heard say a cruel word about anybody. And in New York. Babe was always wearing the latest fashions. Not that she could afford them. Brother, she could not. Pop's Cushing lost all his money in the crash. But Babe was given these gorgeous clothes by simply everyone, because she made exquisite clothes look heavenly, and they all wanted her to wear their fashions, knowing they'd be photographed and in the newspapers. Babe even worked here at the bazaar for a time, then at Vogue, as a fashion editor. She was quite the little career girl. She even had an affair or two. I do sometimes think she was happiest then. She took her work very seriously, unlike most of those society girls who are hired just for their names and connections. Babe had those, of course, but she worked hard, that girl. She went on shoots, modeled some herself. But with Goggs pulling the strings, it was only a matter of time before Babe married, too. And she did, to young Stanley Mortimer, Standard Oil heir. Tuxedo Park, you know, that true old-money Protestant background. Good golly! And Babe quit her job then and had two children. Goggs finally threatened Vincent Astor, and he married Minnie. Then Betsy got the catch of them all, Jock Whitney. So Goggs had a Mortimer, an Astor, and a Vanderbilt Whitney in the family. Then Babe divorced Stanley Mortimer. Well, she had to. He came back from the war an absolute wreck. Not that he was all right even before. There were rumors that he hit her. Plus all his money was tied up in trust, which Babe didn't know before the marriage. But Babe, true to her mother's training, never let on. Those girls were bred, you see. Bred, like show horses. Appearance matters most. Loyal families, no troubles, stick together, put on a happy, perfectly made-up face. Never air your dirty laundry. So you'd see Babe impeccably dressed, so beautiful, going about as usual, but still, there was a sadness in her eyes.
I see it still, Truman whispered.
Well, she has pots of money now, and I've never heard of Bill hitting her, so I don't know why.
Diana scoffed.
Anyway, divorce. I really think Goggs did not approve of divorce, and yet all three of her daughters have had one. Goggs probably thought, well, if I had to put up with a sorry old so-and-so who never cared about me, except for how I ran his house and made him comfortable, so can they. But those sisters are more modern, of course. And in the end, except for Minnie, they each traded up. Cadillac for Rolls-Royce. Betsy had traded a Roosevelt for a Whitney and all that divine cash. And Babe? Well, good God, William S. Paley. He runs everything. The world. Of course he's Jewish. That's the puzzling thing. Babe marrying a Jew. It killed her mother, truly. Poor old Goggs died a couple years after. Oh, by then I think she was reconciled to the money. Good God, who wouldn't be? Rich as Croesus, Paley is. But the Jewish thing? Well, but Babe doesn't mind. I think she takes it as a challenge. You don't want us? Well, then we'll make our own society even better. And she has. Although she was dropped off the social register, of course. Toot sweet. And there are clubs that simply won't have them. But Babe is determined. Rot in hell, those who won't have us. Although Babe would never say such a thing. Too well-bred. Too damn nice. After Goggs died, Minnie divorced Astor. Well, who wouldn't, really, except for all that money? Vincent Astor was one cold fish, only interested in his toy railroads, if you can believe that. True to form, though. Minnie found him his next wife before she left. Those women do know how to take care of their men. Now Minnie's married to Jim Fosberg, the artist. Although he's queer, isn't he? You would know.
Darling Mrs. Vreeland, Truman cooed, with just a hint of ice behind his lisp. As I told you, we are not all members of one big club. Believe it or not, I do not know the name, rank, and serial number of every homosexual in Manhattan.
But you do know about Jim Fosberg, don't you?
Diana asked serenely. Truman sighed. Yes, I do. He is.
Of course. I think Minnie's a bit of a les, too, if you ask me. But that breeding and training, never would she admit it. Probably not even to herself.
I have no patience for people like that, Truman snapped.
Diana looked at him, her eyes gleaming in admiration.
No, I see. True to yourself, that's who you are, Truman. And God bless you. You are a champion. Now, when are you going to give us another story here at the bazaar? You know I don't run that particular show. God, I barely even read. But circulation is always up when we run one of yours.
Darling, you'll be the first to know. In fact, I'm working on something now. A delicious story. But I'm not going to share a word of it yet. It's too soon.
He rose, stretched, way up on his tiptoes, glimpses of his crimson socks peeking out beneath the turned-up hem of his plaid pants. He wrapped a scarlet scarf around his throat with a flourish. Then he leaped around the desk to hug Mrs. Vreeland. who did not generally allow hugs. But with Truman, of course, exceptions were made.
"You are a dear dragon lady, the dearest, and I mean it in the most admirable way. I happen to love dragon ladies. They are fiercely protective of those they love."
"Truman, you could charm the rattle off a snake," Diana Vreeland pronounced. "I'm going to lunch at Le Pavillon. Will you join me?"
"No, my dearest dragon lady. I'm going to work now. On that story. Another time. And do not gossip without me. Do you hear? Don't go to any dives or pick up any sailors. No naughtiness without me, Mrs. Vreeland."
Diana laughed, her great echoing ha-ha, every guffaw as articulated as every syllable she spoke. Truman turned to go, hands in pockets, golden head bent in thought. So lost in contemplation was he didn't even notice that indeed, hovering outside of Mrs. Vreeland's office, were hordes of emaciated mannequins clad in the latest fashions, nervously awaiting their reckoning. He got into a cab and told the driver, "Brooklyn Heights." And the cab carried him across the bridge, up, 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 and then down, 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 away from Neverland, from Mother Goose, from Oz. It pulled up in front of a canary-yellow townhouse on a quiet, tree-lined street. Truman paid the fare and walked down into a basement apartment. And then he went to work.
Chapter 5 Truman at Work. So many wanted to catch him at it, watch as genius burned. Not his fellow authors, of course. They were far too blasé and jaded to care. But his swans in particular all longed to see Truman Capote write. They went out of their way to offer him help, for if they weren't patrons of the arts, then who were they? They weren't patrons of the arts. But Gloria offered him his own beach villa at her place in Palm Beach. Slim provided him with hampers of food from 21, so he would be properly nourished. Pamela offered to sit at his feet, literally, amuse. Marella invited him to work on her yacht, bobbing up and down in the Mediterranean. Truman refused. As much as he loved and appreciated their lives, their comforts, their wealth and bounty, when it came to his work, he displayed a monastic discipline none of his new friends could have suspected. Work was work. Play was play. And never the twain shall meet. Except, well, perhaps there was a time ahead when they could, he wondered. There were marvelous stories here, ripe for the picking, and if Truman wasn't a storyteller, then who was he? Truman was a storyteller. But, for now, the story he was telling was not theirs, although he already knew they would all want to lay claim to it when it was done. But this particular story was entirely of his own invention. He resented the implication by so many that he could write only from his own life. Other voices, other rooms, why, that wasn't autobiographical at all. It was a story, made up in his own mind. The story of a young boy without a family, without a home, seduced into darkness, born into light. But the darkness beckoning, always beckoning. No, his first novel wasn't autobiographical at all. And this new story, he had an idea for a title. He'd heard a sailor on leave during the war tell another sailor that he'd take him to breakfast at the most expensive place in town. Where did he want to go? Well, the naive sailor had replied,
I always heard that Tiffany's was the most expensive place in New York. Breakfast at Tiffany's. It was a great title. That much Truman knew. Beyond that, Truman gathered up a notebook, a simple composition book with lined paper. He sharpened his pencils, settled in on a velvet sofa beneath a window, and propped up the notebook on his knees. His forehead furrowed. He read what he had written the day before, the words in his tiny, squared-off handwriting, meticulous. Spare.
Listen, Fred, you've got to cross your heart and kiss your elbow.
And Truman was lost in the words, awash in sentence structure, agonizing over punctuation. Studying the picture on the page, rearranging paragraph breaks so that there was just enough white space. Going back and forth, in his mind, between the words approximation and facsimile, until finally choosing approximation.
Perhaps contortionists can kiss their elbow. She had to accept an approximation.
Truman worked through the entire afternoon, then stopped. Some internal alarm inside him, as nascent as the primordial switch that turns winter to spring, simply said,
"Enough. Enough for today. One more word and you will question everything you've written so far."
And he put the notebook and pencil away on his desk, scratched himself in those patient places that required scratching, having been ignored all day, and went into the kitchen, where Jack was flinging pots and pans about, preparing dinner. Gruffly. Which was how Jack approached life. Gruffly.
"Good day's work?"
Jack grumbled, viciously grinding pepper over a flank steak.
"Hmm-hmm."
Truman reached for the cocktail shaker with one hand, the vodka with another.
"I'll read you some tonight if you want."
"Sure."
"And you?"
"It's rubbish. It always is."
"It's not.
And you just want me to tell you that, so stop fishing. By the way, the Paleys invited us both to Kelowna this weekend." "I don't want to go."
"Jack."
"I don't like those people."
"Jack, you've not even met them."
"Yes, I have. In various guises over the years, they're all the same. Phonies."
"No, they're not, Holden Caulfield. The Paleys are different. Babies, for sure. And Bill, well, I think he might be too. There's something about him."
"They distract you."
Jack growled.
"They're not worthy of you. I have no idea why you're so fascinated with the rich and famous and pretentious."
"But they're beautiful, Jack. Their lives are so quietly beautiful, devoted to graciousness, taste, decorum. I admire that. I think that's the epitome of living, to be able to create art out of your life. It's what we do, in a way, isn't it, in writing?"
"Hardly."
Jack flung the pepper grinder down with a snort. Jack. Tall and freckled and lean, reddish-blonde hair balding, glared down at Truman, short and pale and lean, blonde hair receding.
"I can't bear the thought of you comparing yourself with your talent to them. It's ridiculous.
And I thought you said you despised Paley after that weekend with those parasites."
"Well, I barely know him. I should be fair."
"Men like that don't deserve your charity, Truman. People in general don't."
"Oh, my misanthropic darling."
Truman sighed, putting his arms about Jack's waist, allowing one hand to slide between the waistband of his pants and warm, yielding flesh.
"What would you do without me to shine light on your dark and dreary world?"
"I did just fine without you before."
Jack growled. But he did not throw off Truman's embrace. The two leaned into each other for a moment, surrendering to a blissful, ordinary domesticity. Oil sizzling in a pan on the stove, fragrant rosemary in a pot on the windowsill,
their two dogs warming their ankles with their heavy, stupid dog breathing. A quiet meal ahead. A martini or two, reading in bed before the lights were out. Familiar yearnings satisfied by familiar bodies. Jack had been a dancer, which never ceased to thrill Truman as he traced those muscles, still retaining their disciplined sculpture, those battered feet with their astonishingly high arches. Truman's body was much less disciplined, but still wiry, with a surprising hardness of the abdomen and biceps, so slender that lanky, raw-boned Jack could almost put two hands about his lover's waist.
Like Scarlett O'Hara,
Truman liked to boast. Then sleep. In their ordinary basement apartment, in ordinary Brooklyn Heights. Manhattan and all its tempting glitter safely across the bridge. For now. It should have been enough, Truman knew. Enough to be with Jack, wrapped in his arms, satiated and sleepy, a good day's work behind him, another ahead. He had projects galore on his plate because he was Truman Capote, literary darling. A trip to the Soviet Union with a touring company of Porgy and Bess paid for, and the resulting story to be published by The New Yorker, his old employer, and his first real publishing disappointment, long ago but never forgotten. House of Flowers, based on one of his short stories, was still running on Broadway, even though it was only a matter of time before it closed. Breakfast at Tiffany's was simmering, percolating, proceeding one agonizing word at a time. He was at the top of his game, he knew. He'd never doubted he'd be there, not even when he'd been fired from The New Yorker, and he loved a darling man who loved him in return, in his own gruff way. But it wasn't enough. And late that night, as Truman turned away from a softly snoring Jack, there was a dancing flame inside of him that would not be extinguished, could never be extinguished, no matter how many sleeping pills he took, no matter how many times he told himself that it could be lit again by the morning sun. But there was always more. More beauty to be seen, more places to travel, more acclaim to be won, more love to earn, to barter, to exchange or withhold. To miss, always. Outside, looking in. Why did he always feel that way, every moment of every day? Even when he was at the center of attention, standing at a lectern reading, slicing into a cake with the cover of his book depicted in the icing, it was never completely his. There were always other things going on. Two heads, bent in conversation in a dark corner of the room. A secret smile between lovers, a peal of laughter prompted by a joke he hadn't heard. People exchanging telephone numbers. Not his. A whispered, "I'll get a taxi for us all." And suddenly, a group of four had vanished with a hurried waggle of their fingers in his direction, blown kisses in perfumed air that never quite reached his cheek. Leaving him behind. He was always left behind. So he had to try harder, be more, be better, more sparkling, more vibrant, a spotlight shining up to the heavens, lighting the dark, drawing everyone to his brilliant beacon. If he only dressed a little more outrageously, why not a velvet cape to go with a velvet suit? If he only danced a little more vigorously, doing the Charleston when everyone else was doing the two-step. If he only leapt into a room, arms outspread, legs kicking up behind him, instead of merely walking into it. If he only told the best stories, dished the most delicious gossip, dropped the grandest of names, then, perhaps, then, would he truly belong? Would Mama come get him so that it would be the two of them, finally? And he would be loved, embraced, and see only pride and understanding in those eyes, those shining, shining eyes, brown, almost black, peering out of a face sculpted out of marble, high cheekbones, aquiline nose, a slender neck, a swan's neck, black, black eyes like a swan, feathers ruffling, arms beckoning. Babe's eyes. He began to relax, finally, thinking of Babe's eyes and how they looked at him, and only him, how they shared a hurt deeper, maybe, than his own, and how they might shine with love, true love, true heart, Truman. And finally, thankfully, he was asleep.
Babe, in her lofty pied-à-terre at the St. Regis Hotel, 55th and 5th Avenue, the epicenter of glittering Manhattan, was not. Bill, in bed beside her, had taken up the entire mattress with his tall, restless body, hard, unyielding, and a stranger to her now. Two children together, and that was enough. She didn't mind that. Two with him, two with Stanley. Babe was a mother of four. Yes, that was enough. But Babe, idealized and idolized perpetually on the best-dressed lists, always mentioned in columns that began "The Most Beautiful Women in New York," was not desired by her own husband. Oh, yes, coveted, perhaps, prized, displayed like one of his Picassos. Mr. and Mrs. William S. Paley, dazzling together at charity events, balls, highly sought after at dinner parties. But Babe was not desired. Holding herself still, so stiff and light she wondered if she even made an imprint on the mattress. She knew only rejection, colder than the air conditioner blowing stale Manhattan air over her body. Bill hadn't reached for her tonight, as he hadn't last night, nor any night that she could remember. It wasn't as if sex was something she craved. Frankly, sex with Bill was strictly a one-sided affair. She couldn't even remember it, to tell the truth. No real details, no exquisite rapture, no lovely, sated feeling after. But rejection is rejection is rejection, as Gertrude Stein might have said. And the truth was that Bill Paley rejected his own wife's body, if not her needs. Babe, beautiful Babe, rejected like a common wallflower by her own husband, whose roving eye was legendary. She thought bitterly of those who had wanted her. Condé Nast, back when she worked for Vogue. How many times had he chased her around his desk? And he was quite handsome for his age, she could now realize. Very trim, sharply chiseled features. But at the time, she thought him absurd. Old enough to be her grandfather. And Sergei Obolensky. She adored Sergei, loved his passion, his exoticism, a real Russian prince. Yet he was so courtly, quite old-fashioned, yet so dashingly handsome, with that little brush of a mustache that tickled. Suddenly Babe couldn't keep still on her side of the bed. She squirmed, flexed her toes, stretched her hamstrings, turned over so that her pelvis pressed into the mattress, remembering how Sergei kissed her one day, the two of them lying entwined upon a gorgeous velvet swooning couch in his apartment. A kiss so deep, stirring so many yearnings. And she would have given in to them, too, had she been able to stifle her mother's voice in her head. But that she could never do.
Sit up straight. Don't fidget. Write a thank you note the minute you receive a gift or return home from a party. Always have fresh flowers, no matter the cost. Clean gloves and shoes are the sign of a lady. Never let the help get the upper hand. Be discreet. Be above gossip. Be a perfect little angel for Papa because he's so rarely home, and when he is, he wants to see only the very best of you. Be a perfect little debutante because Sister Betsy is now married to the president's son. Be a perfect little wife to Stanley because he's old money, Tuxedo Park. Be a perfect wife to Bill, even if he is a Jew, because that's what he's paying for, and if you're not perfect, he'll replace you so fast your head will spin, and then where will you be? Divorced twice with 4 children and no money of your own. Be perfect, because that's what people expect of you now. Because what are you if not that? Who are you?
Perfect. Babe must be perfect in every way. She had been born to be a rich man's wife. Decorative. An asset. She never remembered being allowed to dream of anything else. When she was very small, Betsy and Minnie, Minnie 9 years older, Betsy 7, allowed her to play at being a flower girl for their fabulously staged weddings. It was the only pretend play that her mother sanctioned.
"Now let Babe catch the bouquet," her mother would admonish her older sisters. "Babe has to catch the bouquet so that she'll be next."
Babe didn't want to catch the bouquet. She wanted to pretend that she was someone else. Odile. That was the name she told her brothers and sisters to call her, while she pretended to be an ordinary scullery maid, dirtying her hands, calling them "my lord" and "my lady" in a terrible Cockney accent. Odile was an orphan, admired by all for her pluck and wit. But her mother was so furious. She forbade anyone to talk to Babe while she was pretending to be Odile.
"Do not encourage her," her mother hissed. "We can't have that kind of behavior. What will people think?"
Babe gave up being Odile after a while. She couldn't remember just when her imagination left her. Flew away like a bird. She just knew she was happy being alone in her own dreamy world for a time. And then she was not. She missed her sisters telling her what to do, her brothers coaxing her along in their games. She burned with shame at the dinner table, when no one would speak to her or pass her the salt. So she gave it up, and accepted that she was Babe. Only Babe. She would never be anyone else, anything other than what her mother wanted for her. She willed herself not to imagine her dream, because there was no profit in it. The only profit was in being the best, most perfect little girl in the world, then the best, most perfect debutante, then the best, most perfect wife. Because if she wasn't perfect, precisely who others expected her to be, no one would talk to her, or even acknowledge her existence. She would simply wink out, disappear like a vapor. All that energy she'd had as a child, as Odile. She remembered running just to feel the wind blow through her hair. She recalled rolling down a hill, miraculously not getting grass stains on her dress, and she was so thankful for that. She never did it again, but oh, the dizziness. The delicious head rush, the scratching of twigs against her cheek, the feeling that the sky was on the bottom and the earth was on top, but she remained where she was, by some mysterious force called gravity. All that energy, she learned to channel into the one thing she could count on, as her mother drilled her over and over. Her face, her appearance, her decorative quality. Her mother never stinted on praise when it came to how Babe looked. If her clothes were neat and pressed, if her skin was clear and her cheeks flushed and her hair glossy, if she attracted the stares of the rich young men she met at her sister's parties and dances. Even now, that she was 40 and Goggs was dead, she felt the heavy weight of her mother's admonitions, her quick disapproval, her religious appreciation of beauty and grace and manners, the pulse-racing terror that if she didn't live up to everyone's expectations, she would be shunned, abandoned. So Babe had to rise early, long before Bill, to put on her makeup and take out her hairpins so he would see her at her absolute best when he awoke, as he always had and always would. And to tell the truth, she was dependent on her cosmetics as others might be dependent on alcohol, in a tactile, pleasurable way. She loved the faint, flowery smell of her favorite blush. She delighted in the heavy silver of the brushes, the silkiness of the bristles against her skin. She enjoyed applying foundation, personally mixed for her by Elizabeth Arden herself, taking the sponge and dabbing it on her skin, each dab like a scale of armor. Power. She never grew tired of seeing her cheekbones come into sculpted glory with each swipe of the brush. She stared into the mirror as she blended and stroked and dabbed. And little by little, like pointillism, her face, the face she knew and depended on, emerged into a complete portrait. Perfection. No one had ever seen her without makeup. Not even Bill on their wedding night. Just the thought of showing a bare face to the world. Babe squirmed again, turning away from Bill as if he could read her thoughts and might wake up, despite the fact that he was still snoring steadily. This was one reason why she didn't like the tiny apartment at the St. Regis. She and Bill had to share a bed, as there were only three rooms, at least at Kailuna, and the summer house up in New Hampshire, and in Round Hill, their place in Jamaica, they had separate bedrooms, so there was never a chance he might awaken in the middle of the night and see her naked, exposed, imperfect. Had she ever loved Bill enough to show him her true self? Had she ever loved anyone? Or was this another of her defects? Something else to hide from the world beneath the latest Chanel jacket? She didn't know if she loved her husband, although she appreciated him and enjoyed his company and ached to be touched by him, noticed, wanted for something other than being a very glamorous concierge, which was what Babe was, really. And so, every morning, her makeup and hair immaculate, clad in a fresh negligee and fabulous quilted housecoat, she sat at her desk and compiled her lists. First, she planned all the day's meals, resigning herself to hours of scavenging in the most obscure markets for some new exotic vegetable or fruit to tempt him. Bill loved food, had a voracious appetite, ate several meals a day. She had to make sure they were memorable, each and every one. Seated at the dinner table, she took notes in her custom-made palm-sized notebook from Tiffany's, jotting down Bill's comments about the food, what he liked, what he didn't, so that next time she would not repeat any mistakes. She had lists pertaining to clothes. Bill's blue suit needed its buttons tightened. His shoes needed polishing. Her coats needed storing. The lace on her negligees needed repairing. Her mind, even knowing how early she had to rise, was a list now, as she rolled back on her side, gingerly, so as not to disturb her husband. Tomorrow night was dinner at Quo Vadis with the Guinnesses. Bill wanted her to pick him up at the office before. She must send the chauffeur out to buy supplies to take back to Kailuna this weekend. Mundane, necessary supplies, such as toilet paper and cleaning sprays, and new hand towels for all the guest bathrooms.